John? Good evening, and thank you all for coming. My name is Michael Feldstein, and I'll be chairing tonight's program, which is sponsored by End the Madness. We're very fortunate to have three terrific speakers address various issues of dating and shidduchim in the Orthodox world. Rabbi Shlomo Hochberg, the spiritual leader of the Young Israel of Jamaica States, will speak about the halachic myths and realities of dating. Rabbi Dale Polakoff, spiritual leader of the Great Neck Synagogue and the president of the RCA, will speak about the roles of rabbi and the community in implementing solutions. Finally, Dr. Aliza Dworkin-Frohlich, a psychologist at the Hillel Yeshiva High School in Deal, New Jersey, will speak about teaching socialization skills to our teenagers in today's Orthodox world. First, I'd like to thank Rabbi Schoenfeld and the folks at the Young Israel of Kew Gardens Hills for graciously offering to host tonight's symposium. I'd also like to thank Hananya Weissman for his assistance in promoting this event. The basic goal of End the Madness is to alleviate the stresses and the hardships of dating in the observant Jewish community. We aim to accomplish this by expanding the range of available dating options for observant Jewish singles and to give people the confidence to explore the options that are most amenable to them on an individual level. In addition, End the Madness seeks to promote greater achdus by tearing down stereotypes and encouraging observant Jews with different backgrounds and personal customs to consider one another as viable marriage candidates. On the back of the table, there are copies of some flyers announcing some of our future events this summer, and I encourage everybody to take them on their way out. We're sponsoring a conference on premarital genetic screening featuring Rabbi Moshe Tendler and Rabbi Kenneth Brander at Congregation Oheb Tzedek in Manhattan on June 27th, and that's open to the entire community. We're also sponsoring a game night at Congregation Kehillat Jezrin in Manhattan on Wednesday, August 9th, for those under 30 years old, with pizza being served. And finally, on Sunday, August 27th, not too far away at Shea Stadium on Jewish Heritage Day, we'll be gathering at Shea before the Mets-Phillies game for the world's largest kosher tailgate party. This is the third annual tailgate party that we've sponsored. See the flyers for details about these fine programs, none of which will feel like a typical singles event, we promise. Finally, if everybody could turn off their cell phones to make sure that there are no interruptions, we'd certainly appreciate that. Our first speaker is Rabbi Shlomo Hochberg. Rabbi Hochberg is the rabbi of the Young Israel of Jamaica States and the vice president of the RCA. He is also the Mashgiach Ruchani at Stern College and often gives schmoozes to students about dating and marriage. In addition, Rabbi Hochberg is a member of the Vad HaRabbanim of Queens and a contributor to the OU Torah Insights Project. His topic tonight is halachic myths and realities of dating. It's my pleasure to introduce Rabbi Shlomo Hochberg.
Thank you very much. First of all, thank you for inviting me, and thank you for hosting to Mr. Feldstein and Mr. Weissman. It's really a privilege to be on the same podium as Rabbi Polakoff and Dr. Frohlich, who both have special connections, and you'll hear from them, and their words will speak for them, as mine hopefully will speak for me. The topic is a long topic, and I'm going to give, if you will, some headlines, and there'll be time for questions at the end. I will try to stick to the time frame. I was observing the T-shirt as I came in and reminded me of something that I heard recently from Rabbi Dr. Abraham Twersky, who is well known to us, and he described in discussing what he referred to as the Shidduch crisis as well. He knows how to treat an individual who is Meshuggah, but he doesn't know how to treat a whole community, a whole society that is Meshuggah, and he related to some of the problems which are on the T-shirt, such as the size of the dress or the mother's size of the dress and things of that nature. What I'd like to address is that some of the issues that we face and that we complain about are self-imposed, and some of them are imposed by the society around us. And the fact is, if they're self-imposed, it's because we buy into them. And if we buy into them, we cannot really blame those around us. And I think part of the difficulty is that if we are not willing to take responsibility for our own actions and we're willing to just buy into whatever society tells us, then we are as much at fault as anyone else. And I think End the Madness is trying to, if you will, end that aspect of buying into what society is telling us. People come and look for dates, and they call, and this is a call which is made quite often to rabbis or rebbetzins. They're looking for, and they're looking for something in particular. They're looking for a professional, looking for someone who's learning. They're looking for someone who is thin. It's amazing, sometimes I find that mothers of sons looking for shidduchim are looking for somebody who's thin. They want to know, of course, what kind of yarmulke you wear. I'd like to talk one moment about the yarmulke phenomenon, and this really is an indicator of where I'm going. When I was a student in Shivat HaKotel in Eretz Yisrael in 1970-71, I wore a kippah shugah. At some point, I morphed into a traditional yeshiva yarmulke. And at some point, I decided that I wanted to wear a yarmulke that was nondescript. So I started wearing this yarmulke. And this was described to me as a yarmulke worn by somebody from YU who doesn't want to wear a kippah shugah or a velvet yarmulke. So even the attempt to be nondescript is not helpful, and that kind of terminology really is not helpful at all. A woman was looking for a shidduch and explained to my wife she was looking for an attorney. She wanted someone who's a lawyer, which is quite restrictive, although there are certainly many attorneys out there. And she found someone who she thought was appropriate in terms of hashkafa and all the other things that were criteria, and she wanted to know which law school he went to. And my wife told him, and I won't tell you which law school because it's not relevant, my wife told her which law school, said she wants somebody who went to a real law school. So those are the kind of questions that some people are asking. One particular woman asked, after the other criteria seemed to be fine, does he have any facial hair? For me, a sensitive subject. And because she wouldn't date somebody who had facial hair. And she looked and said, well, he does have a mustache. So she said, well, perhaps if you like him and he likes you and you decide to get married, he would take off the mustache. So she said, I wouldn't want to date the type of person who would have a mustache. And these are pigeonholes that we formulate for ourselves. They're not pigeonholes that are imposed on us by anyone else. The question really is, what is it that we should be looking for? And the Rambam gives us a very clear direction what to look for, an interesting location. You would expect, what I'm going to not quote from, but cite from, you would expect this to be in Hilchos Deos, which is the Rambam's description of personality, and what personalities are good and what personalities are negative, what characteristics one should try to build up and one shies away from. But this is found in Hilchos Isurei Bia. It's the 19th chapter of Hilchos Isurei Bia. Hilchos Isurei Bia is the laws of whom you're not allowed to marry. In the 19th chapter, in Halacha Tezayin, the Rambam says that all families are considered to be Becheskas Kashrus. All Jewish families are known, thought of to be Jewish, you don't have to worry about them, unless Afal Pichein, despite that, there are certain things you want to not look for. And this is a short description. And he has 9 categories. I'm going to only bring a few of them. O Ra'ita Ishtahu Marbem Rivai Makol, somebody who fights with everyone else. Va'az Panim Bioter, and they're very arrogant and bold. Choshim Lahem, you have to suspect who they are. So whether you suspect or not, whether they're Jewish or not, they may have a good yichus brief. But that still is a characteristic that one should be looking for in someone who you want to marry, someone who is not argumentative, rather is easy to please, and greets everyone if you will be safer upon him, yafos. Chena posel asacherim, someone who is overly critical of others. Kagon shenotein shemesh mishpachot ob yechidim. They cast aspersions on others, and casting aspersions on others can be on other Jews because they don't fall exactly into the category that we think is the category that we relate to. Or it can be, and this is 5 more categories down, Soneya Tabriot, someone who hates people. And this is not about Jews, I think it means about non-Jews. There are people who are disparaging to others, and you could find this out in the dating process, and I'll describe a way that I think you could find it out. Ken Komishiyesh Barazupanim, anyone who was chutzpahdik, or Afzari, somebody who was cruel, or Eino Gomelahem Chesed, somebody who is not kind, because those are signs of somebody who is Jewish. Now, I know lawyers who are kind, I know lawyers who are cruel. I know lawyers who learn, I know lawyers who don't learn. I know Torah students, if you will, who are great scholars, but have not integrated into the personality what they learned. I know people who are rather ignorant, but have integrated all the Torah characteristics into the personality and have a very deep Torah personality, maybe based on intuition or maybe based on who they try to emulate, who are their role models, and so on. The main characteristic, I think, that you're looking, that somebody should look for in whom they're dating and therefore whom they want to go out with, is what their midos are like. And what the midos are like means you want to find somebody who you're going to respect and admire, not because of what they earn today, because they may not earn that. I know dentists who never one day practiced dentistry in their whole life. They went into business. And certainly everyone knows people who are in different professions leave the profession, people who are wealthy become poor, and vice versa. Those things are all fleeting. But the person's personality, of course, can be developed and expanded upon and elevated, but a person's personality is essentially what you're going to marry. When we talk about soulmates, we want to find somebody who's been a neshama. And questions that are asked, which are related to that, I think are pertinent questions in the dating process. When someone calls me and asks about someone, what do I know about the person, what do I know about the family, the first thing I tell them, they're a very nice family, and they're a very nice person. And that's true about every single person I know. The reality. What do you want to know? And they say, well, what's wrong? Why? What aren't you telling me? I said, I'm not telling you anything, but what do you want to know? Because what's important to me is not at all relevant. I told you what's relevant to me. They're a nice family, he's a nice person. That's all that's relevant as far as I'm concerned. But people should focus upon what it is that they really want to find out. I know of a particular individual a woman who went out with several yeshiva people when they were dating. They were set up with someone who was described to them as a superior Talmud Chacham, very brilliant and sure to be somebody in the future, going to be a professional, a learner, and so on, all the things that are on everyone's list. And in the process of going out on the date, the person drove and was cut off by someone driving in front of them, and the person reacted in a, say, I'll call it non-Torahic way, and the woman said to the person, you could take me home now. And that really kind of, in my opinion, says it all, because that's what you want to find. You want to find in a date how a person is going to act, and I'll give you some ideas of what I think might be helpful. That's in terms of the internal, what I would call self-imposed. There are things that are external, and that's more relates to how it is that we're allowed to meet. And among the rules, and I'm not telling you to follow these rules, but among the rules that are seem to be prevalent in today's society is you're supposed to be set up by a third party. If you meet somebody at a mixer, so this seems to be part of the methodology, is then you can't say to them, maybe you would like to go out, you're supposed to say to a third party, Shotgun, can you set us up? Can you call the person and find out if we want to go out? So I know there was an article written by actually one of the psychologists in Kew Gardens Hill several years ago, wrote an article about this in terms of the lack of reality in terms of how people should act and react, and that part of normal life is rejection. It's okay that you can call somebody. This was true in my day, and I don't see why it shouldn't be true anymore. You could call someone and ask to go out, and the person could say no. Even after first or second date, they could just tell you, you're a nice person, you're not for me. If they're bold and they're willing to share, they could say why it is they're not for them, and that maybe they want to share, maybe they don't want to share, but certainly not for me is a fairly innocuous statement. If a young man doesn't want to go out with the woman again, with the young woman again, he could also say the same thing. He could call her up and say, it was a fine first date, but I don't think you're for me. Rather than have to call a shotgun and have the person setting it up. I would cite to you a medrash, not the part of the medrash which is the most famous. It's the medrash of Bereishis Rabba in Parashat Samaches. And the most famous part of the medrash is the middle section of the medrash. The end I'll get to later, but the middle section of the medrash is about the famous Roman matron who tried to set up and was not able to set up, and she learned that it's not so easy to set up people, and a Kodesh Baruch Hu does this, and it's very difficult for him to set up, as difficult as Har Sinai. But preceding that medrash is the following three lines. Yeshu holech echel zibugo, v'yesh zibugo yibo etzlo. There were those who go to their shidduch, and there are those whose shidduch comes to them. Yitzchak, Zivu go by flow. Yitzchak Zivu came to him, Dichsiv, Vayar Vineg Malim Boim. He just went out, he was in the field, and of course Eliezer had done all the legwork and brought back Rivka with him. This was, if you will, a classic shidduch. The father sent out a shliach, a shatzim, go find the person for my son. He did. The criteria he used, of course, were not wealth or looks. They were also nidos. That's very well documented. But Yitzchak shidduch was found by a classic shatzim. The other case, Yaakov halach etzel zibugo. So the Medrash only tells you Yaakov went to find his shidduch. It doesn't tell you what's between the lines. And it says that Sivai etzel Yaakov. Yaakov went out. But what did Yaakov do exactly? Yaakov went completely on his own, met Rachel at the well, and just on his own, he decided, okay, I want to marry Rachel. As it turned out, he married not only Rachel, he married Leah. Both of those relationships were perfectly fine. And we should understand, and this is a digression perhaps, we should understand Yaakov's relationship with Leah was perfectly fine. Leah was bothered that his relationship with Leah was not quite as good as with Rachel, but the Torah describes, Vayahav Gamis Rachel, Vayahav Yaakov Gamis Rachel Mileah, Yaakov loved Rachel more than Leah. If he loved her more than Leah, it means he loved Leah and he loved Rachel more. He also loved Leah. It was very clear that they had a good relationship as well, not as strong and maybe not as ideal as we picture the relationship of Yaakov and Rachel. But more to the point, Yaakov clearly went to find his own shidduch. Yaakov married someone whose father was somebody one would never want to have for a father-in-law very clearly. No one would pick a loving for a father-in-law. It's extremely clear that in the dating process today, if a shotgun had to set up Yaakov, Yaakov would never have been set up with Rachel or with Leah, and I would never have been set up with my own wife. My wife is from Peoria, Illinois. She's a Balas Tshuva. She went to Stern College. We met on a double date. We dated to other people. My chavrusa and her roommate. So I took out her roommate. She was dating my chavrusa. It took a lot of months for me to make a second date because of my chavrusa until that was all straightened out. He got married before I did. She got married before we did. And everybody, the three of us, I think three couples, I think perfectly happy with our own mates. But nobody would ever set us up today. It's very clear because my father, Zichron Bracha, was a rabbi and he was a mechanek and I was brought up as a from birth. So who would set up myself with a girl from Peoria, Illinois, who's a Balas Tshuva? Notwithstanding that, there are a few things make estates here. It's Baruch Hashem. I'm very fortunate. You might think she's fortunate too, but certainly I'm fortunate. But that's something which people in the criteria that artificial criteria that people use would not set up. I found her, if you will, myself, not through a shadchan. I'm not saying nobody should call a shadchan to perhaps get dates and find solutions that are not available, but it's very clear that in the model of the Torah, there are these and there are those. There are those whose shidduch comes to them through a shadchan, and there are those whose shidduch comes to them by their own efforts. Moshe Rabbeinu goes to the house of Yisro, and he's set up with Zipporah by Yisro. There's no shadchan involved. It's very clear. They just set it up between them, and that worked out, I think, pretty well also for Bnei Yisrael. You will find, by the way, this is also an aside, you will find many couples in Torah and as well as in Nevi'im Ksuvim, very few of which would fit the model ideal of how we think husbands and wives should operate together and relate to each other together. And notwithstanding that, they all had marriages. The marriages described by the Torah as successful. And successful is not the same necessarily as every moment being in what I guess is referred to in La La Land. There are a variety of other places that you can meet, and I'll say something which, when I say this to Stern College, I always get a few raised eyebrows. I may get raised eyebrows here too. I suspect I'll get fewer raised eyebrows here, but I think it's a very important note to make. At my wedding, my chavrusa, a different chavrusa, a later chavrusa, met his wife, saw his wife at my wedding, sat at the same table, met her there, and started dating and got married. The likelihood when a couple gets married of his friend and her friend being able to pair up with each other is extremely high. After all, if they're shaykh for each other, it makes sense. Their friends also are more or less in the same realm as each other. And that tells you not about really the midos of the people at the table, but it tells you about the hashkafa of the people at the table. More or less, the hashkafa will be, there will be people who will overlap. So I recommend strongly mixed seating at weddings, particularly for the singles. Happens, I like to sit next to my wife also, but that's not relevant. I'll go home, I'll be with my wife at home tomorrow, tonight, and so on. But the singles, if they're not set together, that's a disservice to them. And I'll describe the following picture, which I've witnessed many, many times, close up and from afar. There's a mechitz at the wedding. There's a good reason for mechitz at the wedding. Mechitz at the wedding is so the men don't watch the women dance. That's the purpose. Whether you need it or don't need it, it's a good question, but that's the purpose of it. If you witness in the middle of the dancing, you will see both women, young women, and young men walking to the edge of the mechitza, looking across, and say, I'd like to meet that one. Now that's very deep. What did they see across the hall? He knows how to dance, his tie's good, she has a nice dress. What did they learn exactly across the hall? Nothing, it's impossible. If they sit at a table, even if they would sit five and five, five men, five women, not say a word. The men and women don't talk to each other, which I think is a good idea that they should, but let's suppose they don't. They will at least observe how they relate to each other. If they see how the men relate to the men and women relate to the women, that will at least give them some idea as to whether or not they are appropriate in terms of the characteristics that you happen to be looking for. Of course, it would be a better idea as far as I'm concerned, let them talk to each other, maybe get to know each other even a little bit better. For support, I brought the following source, and you could look it up. It's Igros Moshe or Moshe Feinstein, Chelek Orachayim Aleph, Simon Mem Aleph, section 1 of Orachayim, in the 41st Tshuva. When Moshe Feinstein's children got married, they had mixed seating, with the exception of a few tables, and it was described by someone to me in the following manner. There were a few tables that were separate seating because the other side required separate seating for some of their guests. But Moshe Feinstein's side was mixed seating. Okay. With that background, this particular tshuva is about mechitzas in shuls, and in the middle of the mechitza in shul discussion, he says the following, Uvimakom kibbutz v'divrei harashut, and in a place where there are gatherings which are voluntary, v'atpachatunot, and weddings is of course the tshuva mitzvah, mesupukani, I'm not sure if there's an isur, v'yoter noter, and it leans more shalekha l'isur zed. There's no isur of mixed seating at the dinner part of the wedding. And he brings the following example, which you can look it up, that's why I brought the source, from Korban Pesach. And the details and the technical issues are not really germane for today, but you should understand the following. The Korban Pesach had to be eaten b'chabura in a large group. And whoever was eating from a particular paschal lamb had to eat in the same group. And men and women ate in the same group, and they couldn't sit with a mechitza because that would separate them from the group. And therefore it's clear that the men and women sat together. And he brings one more proof in the same tshuva. There is an issue that the Gemara brings up in Sachim that the Kala, when she would eat, would turn away from the other people because she was embarrassed. So he explains, or Moshe explains the following. It's clear they're sitting mixed seating. She's embarrassed not in front of her father and her brothers, whom she's been eating in front of for years and years, rather, there's other men looking at her, and she might be embarrassed because she's a kala and she wants to be dainty. Okay, so that's why she might turn away when she eats. But it's clear again that they're sitting mixed at the wedding. I spent a little more time on that because I think that that's a potential great moment for couples to meet. If someone can't get beyond the other side of the family, the next shidduch that you're worried about in the family, whatever it is you're worried about, which I would say, please don't worry about it, do l'shem shamayim, HaKadosh Baruch Hu can help you better than, you know, all the people around. But if you're still worried about the wedding, at least there should be some Sheva Brachas follow-up for the single friends in an apartment or in a location where they will be able to interact with each other and perhaps meet. Okay, I'm going to try to get to the end. just a word about where. So it happens to be that my first several dates with my wife were disastrous in the sense that we went to locations where we had to leave in the middle because they were inappropriate. Okay, I'll leave it at that. But because of that, we ended up speaking for hours. But we already had a basis upon which to speak. We had spent time together as a double date. We spent time together on a Shabbaton, which was, in the olden days, there used to be something called Dirshu, which was YU and Stern students used to go to places like Rutgers and Stony Brook and so on. And I found the Chumash from Stony Brook, actually, from the Shabbos flight that I was there from 34 years ago, that was just returned to me this evening. So we had a base upon which to talk already, but couples generally are told to go out today, and they're told to go out to a hotel lobby and talk for 4 hours. So what stranger could you possibly find that you could go and just talk for 4 hours? Pick a stranger, go out for 4 hours. Now, I know you know something about them because of the questions that have been asked previously, but it's so unnatural. And so it becomes an interview. And in the interview process, you may find out a lot of things that you didn't know before and all the questions that you asked, which maybe you didn't have to ask either. But I would recommend settings that are more appropriate and more imitative of life. Even if you go to a restaurant, I know you might be seen, but you go to a restaurant and it's okay to be seen. People do eat out. People eat out with whoever they eat out with. And my personal recommendation is people should try to have groups go out with another couple. I think double dating is a wonderful experience. It gives you a lot of information about how people interact, not just with you and not just as they're being interviewed, but with others. Other locations, which I actually recently heard that somebody recommended that a couple should go to IKEA and look around the store. I think it's a wonderful recommendation because you can look at all the different kinds of furniture. Of course, they're not planning to buy furniture yet. You just met. But you can learn about what the person thinks about shapes and sizes and all kinds of things like that. My own ideas go to things like science museum, art museums, if you're into that. There are sports games. I live in Jamaica State. Cunningham Park is within Jamaica State in the neighborhood. There are games going on every Sunday, every Monday, every Tuesday, every Wednesday. No matter when you go there in the evening, there are sports games going on. Little League, minor league, and so on. It's an event. You watch. Does he think kids are cute? Does she think kids are obnoxious? What do they think about how the children interact, about the how the parents interact on the field? There's a lot to talk about, and it's a background, which is a real-life background, which you probably will deal with in, you know, some years when you have children. Pizza stores, I think, even though they're not expensive, and that's, I think, a good thing, but they're also a location where you will see how others interact. There are lines to wait on. There are real-life experiences that people they can reveal a lot about a person's personality, which gets to my last point, which is about what is the point of dating? What is the purpose of dating? What do you hope to gain by dating? So I think there's a process. And I think the process is not in the first date to find everything you know about the person. I think, in my opinion, the first date is designed to see, can you have a good time with this person? Can you get along? Do you enjoy each other's company? If that's the case, so then it makes sense to go the next step. Can you become friends? There are people whose company you enjoy. Maybe the same gender. So you'll be friends, but it's not going to go beyond that. There can be people of the same gender who you enjoy the company, but you're not going to be their friend because you don't have anything else in common except you enjoy being with them when you go to a ball game. So you'll go with them to ball games, but you won't necessarily be friends with them and discuss other things with them. But eventually you become friends and you discover if you have common goals, and common goals do not mean identical goals, but complementary goals. I think the idea of trying to find somebody who's a clone of yourself is not a constructive idea. A husband and wife are supposed to be a balance for each other. Part of the process, as you begin to see the other person in different contexts, I think it's helpful to build up an imagination, an image, of what it is that they will look like in 10 years or in 20 years with your children at your table, in shul, at Little League, at PTA evening, and so on. And all of this does not ensure a happy marriage. You can find the right person in many different ways, and if you find the right person, that does not ensure the happy marriage. What ensures you have marriages, and this is a study that was done many, many years ago, what is the most important criteria of a happy marriage? It is not ethnic background. It is not socioeconomic status. It is not education. It is not even, this was very sad to me, it is not religion. It is how hard the couple works on making the marriage work. I'd like to just close with the end of the same medrash that I quoted. The beginning of the medrash says, there are those who go to the Zivug and those who come to them. And it quotes about Yitzchak and Yaakov, and it quotes a pasuk for each one. And then at the end of the medrash, after the Roman matron, it says the following, Yeshu Alechiel Zivugol, Yeshu Zivugol, Vlechlo. Same medrash, it sounds like. Yitzchak Ba Zivugol, Vlechlo, Shenemar, Vayetse Yitzchak, Lasuach Ba Soder. Gives a different pasuk. Yitzchak finds his Zivug, and his Zivug comes to him. Yitzchak went to daven in the field. Happens he went to daven in the field, perhaps for shidduch for himself. According to some person, he went to daven for shidduch for Avram, his father, since Sarah had passed away. Yaakov halach eisul zivugosh. And Amar Yitzchak Yaakov b'Barsheva. Yaakov leaves B'Barsheva. Of course, the next pasuk tells us by Efkav Makom he also davened. Which brings me to the last point, and that is davening requires a lot of hishtadlus and requires a lot of davening. And my bracha to each of every one of you here this evening is that all of your tefillah should be answered with tova.
Thank you, Rabbi Hochberg. Just as an aside, 25 years ago, I met my wife at a mixed-eating wedding. Last week, we celebrated our 24th wedding anniversary. I couldn't agree with you more on that. Our next speaker is Rabbi Dale Polakoff. Rabbi Polakoff is the spiritual leader of the Great Neck Synagogue and the president of the RCA. He graduated from Yeshiva University in 1979 with a BA in psychology, and he received his smicha from Reitz in 1982. His first rabbinic position was an assistant rabbi at Congregation Kehillat Jezreel, where he also served as a faculty member at Ramaz. He also taught at the North Shore Hebrew Academy. Rabbi Polakoff recently addressed the topic of Shidduchim at the OU West Coast Convention. His topic tonight is the roles of rabbi and the community in implementing solutions. It's my honor and privilege to introduce Rabbi Dale Polakoff.
Well, good evening, everyone. I'd like to begin with the very first Rashi in this coming week's Parsha. Rashi in Parshas Shlach asks, Lama nismucha Parshas hamiraglim leParshas Miriam? Quoting the Medrash Tanchuma, Rashi wants to know what's the connection between the end of last week's Parsha and what happened with Miriam and the beginning of this week's Parsha and what happened with the Meraglim. And the Medrash says that the connection is that the Meraglim saw what happened to Miriam, how she spoke Lashon Hara about her brother Moshe and how she was punished, and they didn't take Musar from that. And they went ahead and spoke Lashon Hara about Eretz Yisrael. And not only were they punished, but all of Klal Yisrael punished as well. Reb Chaim Shmulevitz brings a fascinating story on this tick of taking Musar. In the story, he speaks about a woman, quite a beautiful daughter, and she wanted her daughter to marry a Talmid Chacham. And the Rosh Yeshiva of the community suggested this young man who was an outstanding Talmid Chacham, one of the biggest Lamdanim in the yeshiva. And the mother checked him out and came back to the Rosh Yeshiva. The mother said to the Rosh Yeshiva, he might be very nice, but he limps. And therefore he's not good for my daughter. The Shidduch never went anywhere. Rav Chaim Shmulevitz says, a week later, the wife, the mother, had gotten up early in the morning and she was serving coffee to her husband. And after she put the coffee cup down, she slipped and broke her ankle and was limping for the next several weeks. Says Rav Chaim Shmulevitz, she thought to herself, that will teach me to serve my husband coffee. As opposed to thinking to herself that she was limping as Musar for the restrictions that she placed on the Shidduch for her daughter. The topic of tonight, of the roles of the rabbis in the community in implementing solutions, implies that there's a problem. And boy, is there ever a problem. We know it by various names, but most refer to it as the Shidduch crisis. That there is a crisis in the world of singles, younger singles, older singles, a crisis regarding shidduchim. probably all of us know all too well exactly what that crisis entails. I had a friend who sent me an email when he heard that I was speaking about shidduchim that highlighted exactly the state of the crisis in which we find ourselves. The email discussed the possibilities that the avos would get married in today's shidduch environment. Avraham, what would they say? You know, he looks from, but he's a Baal Teshuva. And his father is involved with Avodah Zarah, so he's probably not for me. Yitzchak, his grandfather was involved with Avodah Zarah. His father is a Baal Teshuva, and his half-brother is an Arab. Yaakov, they probably say his great-grandfather was involved with Avodah Zarah. His brother went off to Derech, and he wasn't Shomer Negiah before he got married. Probably none of the Avos would have merited getting married in the society in which we live today. It's the crisis for which we need to search as a community for solutions. And I say solutions in the plural because there is no one single solution to this problem. The problem is really in three stages. The first stage is, obviously we're trying to get people together to get married. Therefore, that involves trying to put people together who are compatible, not identical, as Rabbi Hochberg points out, but compatible to build a life together. But even before we get to the stage of marriage, we have the crisis of getting people to meet each other. In the world in which we live today, essentially breaks down into two camps. You heard from Rabbi Hochberg, the Yitzchak, the Yaakov camp. I refer to it as the yeshivish camp versus the modern camp. As much as I hate labels, I believe that labels are sometimes important to help us conceptualize things. Shouldn't label people, concepts are often helpful if they're labeled. So the more yeshivish camp, we have people who deal with shadchanim, whether those are professional shadchanim or friends. And in the more modern camp, we have people who look for events to try to bring singles together in a way which is normal and natural, running the gamut from shiurim, weddings, Simchas Torah celebrations, to, and I believe unfortunately, in our societies, often bars and street corners. Which is better? I don't really know. I think the answer is whichever works is the better approach. I will tell you that when I got married, it wasn't through a shadchan. I'm not sure that I would have gotten married had it been through a shadchan. But for many people, shadchanim work. And for others, the word shadchan, they're allergic to the word. They want to find one their own. Putting all of these pieces together creates this shidduch crisis. But not only trying to meet someone, and all of the struggles in finding that person, but also just living through the dating process is a crisis. Because living through the dating process is very challenging. It's challenging because you need to maintain a life while you're dating. And sometimes you're so caught up in, will he call? Will she say yes? that you can't even live your normal life and pursue your own goals and ambitions, and your life becomes tied up into a knot of meeting people and looking for the next date. Living through dating is a problem of self-esteem. I think they should outlaw something which is known as one and done. The phraseology of one and done refers to going out on one date and making a decision at that one date that this person is not for you. And I hope in Yirtzeh Hashem to talk about that a little bit more in the solutions part. And finally, one last piece of this crisis is our own communities. Because in our own communities, if you're single, you're basically invisible. You don't count. You don't get invited for meals. You're not a part of communal functions. And that's part of the crisis for us as well. So now that we know the problem, let's talk about some potential solutions. Try to understand what role all of us can play in trying to come up with models and modalities for solutions to this crisis. So first of all, we need to be realistic. As much as we might think that the modern approach works better than the yeshivish approach, or the yeshivish approach works better than the modern approach, or as much as we might think that our friends should go the yeshivish way or the modern way, or our children should go one way or the other, the bottom line is that we need to respect the choices that each single makes in choosing the derech. My wife is here tonight, and we have 9 children, which is why she's here tonight, because it's better than being at home. And those 9 children, each, we've seen from the beginning of them already, each have a different derech. Some more yeshivish, some more modern, some working with shadchanim, some avoiding shadchanim. Each one of them has a different derech, and we need to respect their choices and try to work within the framework of those choices. So if you know someone who's working with the shadchan, there are things to do to help them. And if you know someone who's working in a more modern environment, there are things to do to help them also. I hope it's someone calling for a date. So the first idea is that you need to be realistic. You need to take into mind where people are. Let me just share a brief story with you. I had a member of my shul, a young man who got married some time ago, who decided that he was going to be one of the first in his chevra to have mixed seating at his chatanah. We spoke about it and we learned through it, and he was very excited, and he was convinced that his chatanah was going to be the source of several shidduchim. And he was busy dancing in Leibedik, and he didn't get a chance to see what happened, but I, Taka, looked to see what happened at the tables where he put his friends and the kala's friends in mixed seating. So there were 2 kinds of people at that table. There were those who, when they realized the table was mixed, never sat down, but rather either danced or drank Diet Coke the entire night. And then there were those who sat down at the table. And what did you see when you went to the table? The table for 12. You saw 5 young men sitting on one side and 5 young women sitting on the other side with absolutely no interaction between them. Now, as Rabbi Hochberg points out, there's obviously some value even in that. But I would like to go one step further. And I would like to suggest that not only should there be mixed succeeding at chasinus, but there should be a sign next to succeeding at chasinus. That you should place your friends at a table in a way in which they're not sitting off by themselves in the corner. After all, how long are you really sitting at the table at the chasana? Half an hour? 45 minutes? Well, I would imagine that we need to acclimate our singles to be able to sit next to a member of the opposite sex for half an hour or 45 minutes, and that they will survive the evening. I don't know who's going to be brave enough to start this first assigned mixed seating at the chasanas, but it might be a way to integrate singles together. So you need to be realistic. You need to understand where people are coming from. And what I like to do is focus on some possible solutions both within the yeshivish model and within the modern, more modern model. Within the yeshivish model, we can all help by helping the singles that we know with their lists. So what are the lists? So every single has three lists. Whether they're written down on pieces of paper or whether they're kept in the head, every single has three lists. The first list is what I must have in a shidduch. The second list is what I prefer but can live without. And the third list are the things that aren't at all important to me. Depending upon the individual, what's on those lists can run the gamut from I must have someone who davens three times a day to I must have someone who's a size whatever. Two, just read the list on the back of the t-shirts. That's what the lists are comprised of. And those lists are important. They're important because they help singles to learn about themselves, and they're important because they help the shadchan to learn about the single. But I would like to suggest that singles need help with their lists. And who should help them? Married people, rabbanim, friends, parents, grandparents. Why? Because when you're married, you learn a lot about the list that you made up when you were single. You learn that some of the things which you thought were so important on the list really aren't that important. And some of the things that you didn't even think about on the list happen to be crucial. So if you have somebody who's single, or if you yourself are single, go to a married friend and say, can we have a cup of coffee? I want to talk about my lists. And help them out with their lists. And get help with your lists. Because lists are important, but lists also change. The list which you might have written down when you first began to date is not necessarily the list that you have 6 months down the road, or a year or 2 years down the road, or sometimes much longer down the road. So get help with those lists. Number two, in the yeshivisha world, if you have somebody who's in the yeshivisha world, or if you are in that yeshivisha model, so you need research done. Because nobody goes out without having that research done. So find someone who can really help you with the research. What does that mean? It generally means don't call the shul rabbi. I hold that you shouldn't call the shul rabbi, because what are we going to say as shul rabbis about our balabatim? I'm going to tell you this person's not a good person. I'm going to say it's a nice family and he's a nice person. It's a nice family and she's a nice person. But don't call the shul rabbi. But play Jewish geography. Because everybody knows somebody in a community somewhere. And if you're in this world and you're doing research, do some real research and find out about this person. And if you really think this person isn't for you, then move on to the next person. But if you think this person might be for you, So then I think you need to seriously consider going out. And here's a crucial point. You need to go out with people, even if they're mostly of what you want, and not all of what you want. Nobody gets all of what they want in any area of life. So if you're misupak, if you have a question, you say, you know, maybe this person isn't for me. So go out with that person. Unless you can say this person's definitely not for me, I would encourage you to think about going out with that person. And finally, in the yeshivisha world, we can help people by suggesting shidduchim. I heard a fantastic suggestion by Rabbi Pesach Krohn. He has a recent tape on time management. But that tape, Rabbi Krohn talks about something that he implemented as a personal solution. Because he often hears names of singles or somebody says, do you know anybody for this one? He says, I'm never able at that moment to think about who I might know. So he carries in his pocket index cards, blue index cards and pink index cards. A little bit sexist, but it works. And when somebody meets him at a chasana, at a talk, and somebody says, you know, I have a single, do you know anybody? He pulls out the blue card or a pink card and he writes down that information. He says he goes home and he has a file. Calls it his matchbox file, where he has all of the blue cards and all of the pink cards. And occasionally he goes through and he sees, oh, you know what? Yeah, I do have somebody. Yeah, I do. He never would have thought about that person if he didn't have those cards. So we can help out. Everybody can make a shidduch. Even if you're single, you can make a shidduch. Making shidduchim are not restricted to married people. Some of the best shidduchim are made by single people. I went out with him, he wasn't for me, but he's right for you. So keep an index card file. And every once in a while go through it and help make those shidduchim. And if you're more in the modern world, you can do this, you can all do this by helping to create acceptable avenues of social interaction, such as this tonight, or other avenues. And that's where the Rashi Yeshiva play a crucial role. Because the Rashi Yeshiva, who have lent their support to these kinds of innovations, need not only to say the words, but also to convince their Talmidim that mixed seating really is okay at a chasana. They say it. But every one of their students thinks they're saying it because of the pressure, they're saying it because it's the politically correct thing to say, but they don't really mean it. Rashi Yeshiva needs to say, we really mean it. This is really what you should do. And to participate in events that bring singles together. It's very late. I just want to close with two other ideas. I think we'll take questions at the end. Two other ideas. And that is, everybody can help someone who's single in both the pre-date and the post-date. What's the pre-date? So the pre-date means that sometimes you can be helpful in advising someone who's single how to date, how to dress, how to date, how to go out. You know, it's interesting, when I was growing up, I was taught by my mother that you always had to open the car door for the woman. That was back in the days before we had, you know, those electronic locks that you can just flip them open. But you always had to hold the door open. But that was the proper thing to do. That was the menschlich thing to do. And perhaps we need to be able to teach people who are dating how to live in a menschlich way with each other. All kinds of crazy things that happen in the dating world. I know a young man who's very much in the yeshivisha world who goes out on a date with two umbrellas in case it rains. one for him, and one for the girl. I suggested a very large umbrella, and he said that was pasnished. So two umbrellas, one for him and one for the girl. We need to work on these kinds of things and actually predate. I think it's a good idea that if you have a child who's dating or you know someone who's about to enter this parsha of dating, that you should take them out for a date. A young man should go out with his sister or with his mother, or a guy should go out with or a woman should go out with her brother or her father, to go through the process, to learn what it's like to develop that ability to interact and to be a mensch towards each other. And finally, a post-date. After the date, there's often lots of confusing feelings. Is this the right person? Is this not the right person? Should I go out a second time or a third time? Should I not? And sometimes it's helpful to have someone to discuss that with. Find a friend you trust and talk it through with someone else. Someone who can give you insight from a little bit of a distance. And someone who I hope can encourage you to always go out a second time. Unless you show up at the door and you wonder if you have the wrong address. But if there's any doubt in your mind, go out a second time. It's the menschlich thing to do. It's good for a person's ego. They feel good about themselves. And building up self-esteem is part of the solution that we can offer during this shidduch crisis in which we all find ourselves. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Rabbi Polakoff. Our final speaker is Dr. Aliza Dworkin-Frohlich. Dr. Frohlich is a psychologist and a Judaic studies instructor at the Hillel Yeshiva High School in Deal, New Jersey, where she has worked for 10 years. She has a degree in school and child clinical psychology from Furkauf Graduate School, Yeshiva University, and a master's in Jewish education from Azrieli Graduate Institute of Yeshiva University, and a master's in specialist degree in school psychology from Queens College Graduate School. Dr. Frohlich has lectured on mental health topics relating to children, adolescents, and families. Her topic tonight is teaching socialization skills to our teenagers in today's Orthodox world. Please welcome Dr. Frohlich.
Thank you for having me. Although I'm not a rabbi, I do have some rabbinic genes, being the daughter of a rabbi, so I therefore also tend to be verbose. So I too will attempt to consult my watch as everyone removes their watch and make sure to stick to the time frame. Little did Mr. Feldstein know that when he contacted me to discuss the role of the school in preparing our students to interact with the opposite gender, this was a topic with which I'm particularly familiar. My dissertation topic actually focused on studying co-ed schools versus single-sex schools in the yeshiva system. My focus, although, was particularly on girls' attitudes towards math and science, but in doing so, I was able to expose myself to the plethora of research which exists in the social-emotional arena as well. And to sum it all up in one sentence, the research, basically, as to the superiority of single-sex versus co-ed schooling is numerous with no clear resolution. This research is independent of any academic benefits, of which there are numerous. And if you're interested, I can share the results of my dissertation with you later. But of course, independent of any, and of course, all this research was independent of any halachic issues involved. Today, I'm going to focus on one question. Does being in a single-sex setting rob our students from cultivating the appropriate intergender social skills? Is limited cross-sex peer interaction an issue? And how does it affect our kids? One area focused upon in the research, again, this is the secular research, is in the area of classroom climate and school atmosphere. Again, for our benefit, I will focus on the intergender issues. One of the first researchers in this field, Dr. Richard Dale, discussed that he felt the social benefits of a coeducational setting far outweigh any negative aspects. He felt that life in a coeducational setting is an extension of natural family life and allows the students to gain an understanding of the opposite gender. And of course, most of the students he surveyed said they preferred co-education. Deem responds, famous researcher Deem responds, that the student's preference obviously is no indicator. Of course, they prefer a more social setting, he says, and co-ed schools, he claims, hold less academic pressure in that way. And much of the research states that even if you were to agree with Dale, for argument's sake, does this social aspect outweigh many of the areas of academics, self-concept, attitude, gender bias, and student achievement which appear to improve in single-sex schools? So again, it's a toss-up. Others attempt to state another issue that they find in single-sex versus co-ed schools is that in single-sex schools, they state, there are stereotypical views of males and females are more easily established. And this is based on what they call the contact hypothesis, which states that most stereotypes exist due to lack of contact with the group. Consequently, misperceptions exist, and if we were to expose the groups to each other, the stereotypes would break down. Males and females would understand each other better, and in our context, making for better relationships as adults. On the other hand, Dr. Cornelius Riordan disagrees and states that the opposite is the case. Gender stereotypes seem to be largely unchanged as a result of contact, and in fact, biases are usually reinforced in co-ed settings. Riordan also stated that cross-sex peer interaction found in co-educational schools often exposes girls to sexual innuendo and more bias, and is not just a natural extension of family life. So, when it comes to determining whether single-sex schooling is good for the skills of intergender interaction that our children have, it's a toss-up. We intuitively feel that it's not good for them, but as we see, more research needs to be conducted. But bottom line, let's be realistic. The research probably will not affect the practical setup of many of our Orthodox schools either way. So we need to make sure that our students get the best of both worlds, the benefits of a single-sex education with the strong skills that they need. And schools need to make those social skills a priority. These are life skills as important as any subject they'll take in school. Our goal is to develop successful, productive, and well-adjusted children, and we need to play a role in that. And who do I mean when I say we? I mean that board members and administrators need to make a firm commitment that some of what we call traditional, quote, academic classes will have to be cut in order to make room for these topics in our schools. And we need to realize that the topic of preparing our children for relationships is just a drop in the bucket of life skills that our children need in all areas: independence, self-esteem, respect, assertiveness, etc. All of these skills speak to issues like substance abuse, eating disorders, teens going off to derech, all of these issues. We need to pay more attention to the emotional development of our students. And schools are moving this way. I'm president of the Yeshiva Counseling Network, a group of counselors in Yeshivot, and we are constantly sharing ideas of how to incorporate what we call the emotional curriculum in our schools. And more schools are actually having a course in which students confront these issues. But as parents and future parents, we have the power to assert pressure on our schools in a productive and a supportive way to make this emotional curriculum a reality. So let's talk about some practical things that can happen in our schools. Despite the fact that our students are mostly non-co-ed classrooms, there are ways to prepare our children for relationships through implementing these curriculum, as I stated. Rabbi Polakoff mentioned, the importance is to learn and to practice these skills. And these curricula do not begin in 12th grade, but rather span K through 12. And for many of those skills they will learn in elementary school are the skills that contribute to a good marriage and good dating, and of course for interactions in general. And some of these skills, like I said, need to begin at the younger grades when they're still co-ed. And we can see that there are many ways that we can create activities when they are together to integrate effectively in that setting. But I'm going to focus more this evening on the high school curriculum, for this is where we see it as becoming inyanei d'yoma more. But keep in mind, like I said, the importance of this work throughout the grades. I also want to note that there is a plethora of secular curricula out there on these topics that can be easily modified for the yeshiva system. And note, these curricula out there are created for mostly co-ed schools, which I believe is telling us that all students need to learn these skills. We cannot assume that they will absorb it from their surroundings. And so let us not limit this work to single-sex schools as well. And to further illustrate this, we, in my school, have been incorporating topics like this into our curriculum in the co-ed yeshiva that I work in. So these topics, like I said, are imperative in co-ed settings as well. What are some of the topics to be covered? And I'm going to just go through a list and sum up some of the issues at the end. Number one, the dating game. Is it a game? Are there rules? Is it a race to see who wins first? Most of our religious kids do feel it's like a race amongst their friends. How can we help prepare them for that, or perhaps even change that? Another skill. If we begin with dating, we need to realize and remember how uncomfortable it is to go out with someone you may not know well, how confusing the awkwardness of the beginnings of a relationship are, how painful breaking up can be. We need to prepare our kids, again, for all those things. Another area, how to make the first phone call. What if? Some of the practicalities. Dating etiquette. These are things that we can be teaching these skills to our kids. Number four, must dating be painful? Some of the side benefits of dating, learning more about yourself, as was mentioned, and things like that. Personal values. How do you determine your values? How do you express your values to your partner or to your date? How do you cope with the conflict of values between yourself and a person you're dating or married to? Another important skill. Obviously, what do I want in a relationship? How do you choose the person? And then, of course, is the most important, communication skills. Some of the practicalities of how to start a conversation, how to be a good listener. Many dates often end with the feeling of, like, he didn't listen to a word I said. So, and again, those are role-playing. Those are actual things that can be practiced. Conflict resolution, debunking some of the myths that it's okay to have conflict in a relationship, but how to deal with that. Parental expectations. Do my parents have specific expectations concerning who I date and marry? What is their role in limiting my choices? When do I know if I'm ready for marriage? Dealing with stress in general in a relationship. That leads us to even warning signs of abusive relationships, very important topic for high school students. Self-awareness in general, who am I? Getting to like yourself before you can attract the right one. The ability to focus on one's strengths and realize one's weaknesses that need to be worked on. Maintaining your own identity within a marriage, a very important topic. Anger management. Gender roles, society and community expectations. In reading some of the recent articles written and published by End the Madness, important to see that particularly men often are scared off by non-traditional expectations for women that might exist today. And I think that particularly with the boys, this is an important topic. What is a healthy relationship? Talk to them about romance, which leads us to the fantasy of what a relationship may be, influenced by the media, the literature, versus the reality of what a relationship is. Relationships in halacha, of course. Stereotypes and community pressures. Much of that is culture-based. I've been in deal for the past 10 years. The Syrian community expectations might be very different than the expectations here in Kew Garden Hills. And how to cope with those expectations, we need to talk to the kids about that. What is love? How does physical attraction fit in? What do you feel about marriage in general? Is this something that's fearful to you, exciting? What happens when you confront issues of contention, finances, extended family issues, religion, childcare, household responsibilities, children's education? Again, all of this seems so far off to a high school student, but this is our last chance. We have them, and we need to talk to them about it. And we'll talk about that statement of being the last chance in a minute. Equality within a marriage, who wears the pants in the family, healthy interdependence versus dependence in a relationship, can you change your partner, the importance and skill of just casual conversation, which we need to teach them, letting go of negativity and cynicism and becoming someone with whom it's pleasant to be around, talk to them about the work that relationships demand, and of course, something that's so important is body image. We want to talk to them about cultural influences, media, the magazines. Our girls are so self-conscious of their bodies and what boys are thinking of them. And this tremendous focus on being slim must be discussed with both the boys and the girls. And very important, I know we spend a lot of time talking to the girls about these issues, but we don't talk to the boys about how the way they look at the girls affects the girls, and that's such an important topic. So what I do is an overview of things that we're trying to do in my school and many schools are trying to do. But there's still some questions that I think as a group we need to think about before we leave. Number one, perhaps there is a benefit, is there a benefit for students to be in separate classes when they learn about these topics? Do we find that for girls particularly, they might feel more comfortable expressing their views with boys out of the room? Practically, just the way it works in my school is, again, we are a co-ed school, but these types of topics we do separately. And again, that's something that every school needs to discuss. There are some topics that it's very beneficial for them to be together in the same room so they can hear each other's views. Number two, what type of person is qualified to implement this curriculum? Does he or she need to have a mental health training? Should only males teach males and females teach females? Again, topic of discussion. And number three, another question we can look about, how do these curriculum topics carry over to other areas outside of school? Camps, youth groups, shuls. There's no reason that these kinds of programming can't happen in shuls as well. It's another way to get parents to come down, another way to get students to come down. The shul has become really a center for mental health issues as well. It's very important. Number four, how about college-level programming? Or better yet, in Israel, when they are ripe for change and it's coming closer to reality. Another question to look about is, I want to focus in this question on the issue of social skills in general. How many of our kids are as socially adept as they should be, not only intergender, but in general with adults? Are they ready for job interviews? Are they comfortable meeting new people? They're not. They really aren't. I meet high school kids every day, and they're not. We need to think about why. Is it that in today's modern Orthodox world, we baby our kids and they don't need to take responsibility? Instead of them feeling comfortable to talk to a teacher, for example, we'll run to call the school for them. We need to foster independence in our kids so that when they go out on their first dates, it is not the first time that they need to face an uncomfortable situation themselves. They can't send their parents on their dates for them. And the last question I just want to focus on is, why is it that students in co-ed settings still need this curriculum? Some might just easily say that it proves that co-ed versus single sex is not the issue. But I also think that the heavy influence of the media, as I mentioned before, detracts from our kids' ability to attain these skills. Because in general, the media distorts their ability to sustain genuine relationships. What do I mean? I mean they envision the fantasy, the soap operas they see on TV, the romance, and they cannot have realistic relationships. This is no different from what happens in the secular world. Dr. M. Scott Peck, a practicing psychiatrist, discusses in his book, The Road Less Traveled, the various obstacles to love that he has seen his patients confront. He states that he sees that people only expect the lightning and falling in love experience, and they don't know how to love. They have the illusion that the intense love at first sight feeling will last forever. Quote, "This illusion is fostered in our culture by the commonly held myth of romantic love, which has its origins in our favorite childhood fairy tales, wherein the prince and the princess, once united, live happily ever after. As a psychiatrist, I weep in my heart almost daily for the ghastly confusion and suffering this myth fosters. Millions of people waste vast amounts of energy desperately and futilely attempting to make the reality of their lives conform to the unreality of the myth. Example, Mr. B. laments, I regret I didn't marry Miss C. I think we could have had a good marriage, but I didn't fall head over heels in love with her, so I assume she couldn't be right for me." And so our kids are bombarded by these media myths, and they therefore can't form relationships. We need to clearly teach them in school the realities of marriage, dating, love, and students in co-ed settings need this too. Another area, Markman, Stanley, and Blumberg in their book, Fighting for Your Marriage, discusses in recent years they have seen the emergence of what they call negotiation-based relationships. Quote, "Today's relationships require more skill in negotiation between partners than ever before. What this shift means is that couples are now more greatly affected by their ability to handle conflicts and differences than perhaps ever before. For couples who have wonderful skills in conflict management and problem solving, that's not a big deal. For the vast number of couples who don't know how to work through issues, problems, that is the problem." And that's really an important focus of our curriculum. We must teach conflict resolution in our schools starting from nursery. And that's where it's at. And lastly, this same book continues to quote historian Barbara Defoe Whitehead, who notes that, quote, "Societies have become more consumer-oriented. There is an increased emphasis on being satisfied with what we get. What's in it for me? becomes a more acceptable way to think, forcing people to expect more and definitely not willing to negotiate differences. Again, our kids need to be taught the skills of overcoming that, what's in it for me. Because in a relationship, it's not about what's in it for me, it's about what's in it for us. And our kids are having a hard time with that. And so as you see, our children are facing a world in which competent social and relational skills are more important than ever. As yeshiva parents and educators, we need to take the responsibility seriously and begin planning to incorporate these skills into our yeshiva curriculum. Thank you.
That was terrific. Thank you. I think all three of our panelists deserve a big round of applause. We're going to take questions from the audience now, and this is a very important part of tonight's program. I realize that this is a very emotional topic for many people, and that some of you may want to vent about your own frustrations that you've experienced in the area of dating and shidduchim. However, in order to make sure that the question and answer session is most productive, we ask that you keep your comments focused on a particular issue that one of the speakers has discussed, and that you ask a specific question rather than ramble on endlessly. We'll try to get to as many questions as we can, but there may be some time constraints. So if we can't answer every question, you are welcome to speak to our presenters or to Hananya or myself after the program is over. Are there any questions? Yes, right up here.
I'd like to make a statement, not a question.
I wanted a question, though.
Okay, just put it. The only way that you can accomplish what you have said today, if the rabbi, which you insulted, if you take one step at a time, how do you get all these rabbis to go along with what you're saying?
Okay, that's a good question.
One thing, if it's one thing only, at every wedding, mixed seating, then you can go a step further. This is something I've been trying to accomplish for 33 years. I've called one rabbi after another. Everyone seems to be afraid to say what you said.
How do you get the rabbis to take the step? That's a good question. What do you say? Yeah, we could do that, sure. If I can get it out. There you go.
It's a great question. The fact that you've been doing it for 30 years and haven't been successful is indicative of the problem. But I would say we don't need to focus on getting all of the rabbis to do the same thing at the same time. We should try slowly to build a critical mass, try to get a few more rabbis on board and a few more rabbis on board. And hopefully by doing it that way, we'll be able to try to turn this a little bit. It also requires, you know, I could get up and I could say to my shul that I recommend that you have mixed seating at your wedding. And then what's going to happen is these young men and young women who go to Israel and who are influenced by wonderful Rosh Yeshiva come back and say, what does the shul rabbi know? Or he's a shul rabbi, what does he know about this? And they'll have separate seating regardless of what I say. So it's a process, and you're absolutely right to be frustrated by it, but that doesn't mean we can stop trying to achieve it.
Rabbi Hofford, any additional comments? Right. Yes, right over there.
I think as a parent, most of what I heard or things that I said or taught my children was when they were babies. Like, I know a lot of kids think love, but the truth is, I think the root of it is parents are not speaking to their children. Parents spend very little time with their children, and the school can't perform a miracle, or the school, or the rabbi, or the camp. I think we, as parents, have to be much more outspoken and much more open. Because a lot of these prejudices just keep going, just on my right hearing, that a woman said to me, well, for the boy that's 40 this year, we allow stereotypes, and this was among the woman. So the more we allow stereotypes into our home, they're in every home. These things with dress sizes for men or women, they start at home. And I think the schools, as you work in deal, how much can we combat in a school if we don't have parents on board? We don't have enough parents.
Okay, so what can parents do?
I think that any good curriculum in school also belongs to the parents. don't have skills on how to teach these skills to their children. They didn't need to be taught when they were growing up in the dorm, in the atmosphere. And like I said, the whole that our people are living today is not in the atmosphere anymore. We can't take it for granted. And parents do not have the skills on how to teach these skills to their kids. And so any responsible curriculum needs to go along with the parent workshop often. And parents need to be updated as to what their kids are learning in the classroom, so that when they come home, they can discuss it with their kids. And so I think you're correct, but parents workshops are a piece of it. And how do the parents come out of the parent workshop? It's a different question. I think the answer for us is that it's not enough for the school to do it, and it's not enough for the school to do it. And it's not enough. You need to have lay people, you need to have rabbis, you need to have professionals in the school who are working together on this issue. And you need to harass school people to come out. That's how it works. But it can't just be a school issue, it can't just be a school issue, it can't just be a layperson issue. It has to be the combination. Absolutely.
Thanks. Any others?
Can I just jump in for a second?
Sure.
I'd also like to make another suggestion, and that is that the schools have mandatory parent evenings. There are a number of schools that do that, where parents must attend a particular evening. And if we're able to do that, if we would encourage our yeshivos to do that, where there are three evenings that parents do. I have a child in yeshiva, and I didn't go to the first two mandatory evenings, and I got a very nasty letter saying that you had better show up at the third evening. Well, I showed up at the third time, scared to death. I showed up at the third evening, and if we have the yeshivos who are doing that, then they may be able to use these forums to try to get some of these problems across.
Yes, in the back. Stand up.
I think the problem starts with the child. If the schools were the schools that want even a small part of what the role mentioned, it would help. Because I was under the impression that it was practically a mitzvah for boys and girls to avoid each other and not to do with each other. To go from that debate, very difficult.
So
I went through my teens and most of my 20s with the idea that I'm also a board member.
So you're asking, so your question is?
Not really a question, it's just a comment.
Okay, go ahead.
Right, okay, so makes being a musician not be fancy, right? Okay. Sort of the in the middle. But in terms of men working between women, there are issues about men working between two women. There is what you might call alternate seating, and that is man, woman, woman, man, which is if you sit many times you come to a table, and even if they're modern orthodox, they'll still sit that way just because it's convenient. The husband will sit next to the wife, and the wife is more comfortable sitting next to another woman because they'll schmooze, whatever it is, and they'll sit that way. So that type of seating certainly is a lot more acceptable. There is a question about men walking between two women, I think, more than sitting between two women. But it, right, but so that may be part of it, but I think the crux of it is really about their opposed to the intermingling, which I think is incorrect. My humble opinion.
Right over there.
Just for singles.
don't have to exist in single groups.
Great ideas.
Rabbi Hochberg is going to be the next president of the RTA, so hopefully that's his place. I often think of the Young Israel movement. The Young Israel movement began as a social environment for people to come together, and I hesitate to mention this on tape, but there are actually people who met at Young Israel-sponsored dances. Revisionist history might look at it differently, but there were actually dances that young religious people came to, and they actually met at dances. So there's clearly a need to have these kinds of events. I'm not suggesting dances necessarily, but clearly a need to have events where people can come together. I happen to think that that's not the RCA's forte. And there are plenty of other wonderful organizations, such as Endemans, that can do these kind of programs and others. I'll tell you what I would like to see the RCA do, and that is we have a built-in resource. Every rabbi in his community has a list of singles. And you know what? We don't talk to each other. I have my singles in my community. Rabbi Hochberg has some singles in his community. So imagine 1,000 rabbis across the United States, each with a list of their own singles. And if we spoke to each other, how many potential shidduchim could come out of that list? We don't even talk to each other about those things. So to me, that's a very important area that we need to focus on. And I certainly hope that Rabbi Hochberg, in his next 4 years as president of the RCA, will focus on those issues.
I have a question for Dr. Pollack, if I may. How important do you think the year in Israel is in terms of shaping the attitudes of our youngsters toward dating and marriage, and what can be done in this area to accomplish some of the things that you're talking about?
I think that the year in Israel is important for many reasons. Number one, it's the first real time that the kids are away from their parents. So their impressions are being formed independently of their parents. So that's one reason why it's an important year. I think even if children don't go to Israel, I think that year is a formative year for teenagers in general, their first time being away from home. They're looking for something. They're looking to develop their own mind, their own identity. And so oftentimes, kids deal with it in two ways. They either adopt the identity of the person who becomes their role model that year, whether it's a peer, whether it's an adult, or they, an independent spirit will find their own, whether it's through research, through reading, through experiences. So they are ripe for change, for any sort of change that year. And that is why many yeshivos have on-staff psychologists now in Israel, and they're definitely working on things of that sort. But I think in terms of the shidduch scene, I think that many of these kids, some kids aren't going to start dating when they get back, but some of them will. And I think this is really, now, like, they're really thinking practically about how will this affect my life. And because the schools tend to serve as such important role models for our kids who are changing so much that year, whatever they can incorporate that year in terms of life choices, again, facilitate the students in helping them make good life choices, not to tell them what life choices they need to make. And so I think, again, this is an area where parents need to exert pressure. I think that's the way it works. The parents want something, it happens. And I think that we as parents, when we send our kids off to Israel, we need to tell our schools that we're worried about this issue. It's something that's important to us. The directors of these programs, they want the students, they want recruitment. There are many schools out there today, and every school is trying to kill an itch. So we need to tell our schools and our yeshivos what we expect from them. And I think that's an important year for them.
We'll take two more questions before we close. Right over there?
I only have one, but it's coming from someone else, right?
Yeah.
All right, Dr. Perlow presented, she spoke about the necessity to discuss with young adults and high school kids, young adults, the expectations of marriage, something that obviously not just young adults, but many people also can learn. So I think one of the greatest lessons that people learn when they get married is that marriage is an imperfect institution. I'm not saying negative. And the question I'd like to hear from each of the speakers, if possible, and I hope the differentiation possible to have a fantastic marriage, or is a more likely expectation, a more likely actual situation to have a very good marriage? And I hope, again, that the difference would be valuable by people, because if we hear answers that really would direct people when they are dating as to what to look for. If I'm looking for someone, for instance, to have a fantastic, amazing, idealistic type of marriage, I might look for one type of person. If I'm looking for a very good marriage, I'll look for something similar, but I will taper it differently.
Okay.
I have some comments, but I'm gonna leave it up to the panelists.
I hope it's a fair question.
It's a fair question.
I think what kind of marriage a person develops, whether it's good or fantastic, is not based on what they think they're going to get when they're dating. It's based on how much effort and work both the wife and husband put in during marriage. If they put enough work in, it'll be fantastic. If they put enough work in, it'll be good. If they put no work in, there's nothing there.
Well said.
Just put a second word of what Rabbi Hopper said, and perhaps add one thing to it, and that is that I think one of the best indications of successful marriages are the communication skills that people have as they go through this process of getting married and remaining married. The better communication skills you have, the stronger the basis for conflict resolution and for maintaining that marriage over rocky periods and helping it, giving it the time to grow into this fantastic marriage. And that's something that you need to look into yourself for to see what you have before bringing it to someone else.
I just wanted to say that I think it's absolutely very possible to have a fantastic marriage, but I think that we need to help our kids and our adults change their definition of what fantastic is. And that's really what it's about. A fantastic marriage doesn't mean flowers every day. A fantastic marriage means a place where you feel comfortable, where you're building something important together, where you're working out your differences and happy. And I think the problem is that our kids do not have a correct definition of what fantastic is. But that's what it's possible.
In the back, last question. Stand up, please.
I would recommend what you just described, two men to women, but frankly, it doesn't really matter. Even if it's, as I thought, described half of one side of the table and the other side of the table, if they're interacting, they can interact across the table. If you make a table of 18, such interaction is impossible. If you make a table of 10, the table's small enough, even if it's a round table, they can interact. They still have to interact. It may be useful, and this is in general when people have, say, Shabbat Shalom in the shul, for single, they generally try to have some young married at the same Shabbat home. I would tell you, we had about 2 months ago, or the first Shabbat week it was, at our shul for Shabbos, at Scotland Resident. Friday night, we had a program. Some singles did not come to the big dinner with our Shabbat. Right? Some singles didn't come because they felt passionate. So if Shabbat is there, what would be passionate? To comprehend that. But we arranged that there should be couples who were no longer living in the community but were friends with the community who would be there. So therefore, it wasn't only the singles to send to themselves, but automatically built in interaction between males and females at the table, because even the husband and wife, young husband and wife, would feel comfortable talking to their spouse's friends and cause interaction to go that way. So that may be a better way to set up seating, not only singles, but age-wise, so to speak. And the same would be true if you have middle-aged singles, put them on middle-aged married. And that would be a way for them to interact more comfortably and not feel that they're pressured to do something unnatural.
Thank you. There will be a Mara opinion in about 15 minutes at 10:05 at the close of the program. And Everybody is cordially invited to hang around and enjoy some light refreshments. Before we close, I'd just like to make one final introduction. The last 3+ years, I've had the pleasure of working with Hanani Weissman, the founder and the guiding force of In the Madness, and we've made tremendous progress. Many people are now aware of the organization and are supporting our cause, and I'd like to call on my friend Hanani for some closing remarks.
Thank you, Michael. Thank you to the speakers. Thank you for everybody for coming. I'm going to speak for less than 2 minutes because the hour is late. Really, I just have one question to ask everybody, and that is, now what? The speakers were wonderful. They gave us a lot of food for thought. And when everybody leaves this room tonight and goes home, what happens next? Everybody's here tonight because we care about the issues, we care about other people, and I would like to see more people come. But we are all on the front lines because we're here and we care. So we're the ones who have to take the next step and actually do something. In this week's Parsha, we read about our ancestors who had the opportunity to enter Israel. They turned down the opportunity was taken away from them. Then they wanted to get the opportunity back, but it was too late. They had to wait another 40 years. The Shidduch crisis is a terrible thing in many ways, but it's also an opportunity for us to do wonderful things and help lots of people. It's our opportunity. We should take advantage of the opportunity now and not wait another 40 years. So please, anybody who wants to do anything to help within the Madness or in general, please see me, please see Michael. The minimal level, you can sign up for the mailing list. You can find out about future programs. You can forward that to other people as well. Speak to us and hopefully do more to help. Thank you very much.
Michael Powell? Oh, I'm sure there is a carry on. Oh, I don't know who's affiliated, but it's a popular name.
How are you?
I've met you.
Yes.
I'm Henny. I'm going to be my daughter.
How are you?
They would come and host you. So,
thank you. Breakfast and
okay.
Possible as well as elementary school.
Size 100.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
Okay. And now.